Hey, y'all, I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
And I'm really grateful to be here. Thanks for asking me, Billy. And thanks all y'all for coming out. This is a great turnout to me on a Sunday night. You know, I love going to meetings when I'm out of town and seeing how it works everywhere. And I was in a meeting in California last Sunday and then Charlottesville this morning. And now I'm here, so... With Virginia Beach, that's at least four different cities in the last week, so that's good. And it works everywhere, you know, it's amazing. And it's pretty much, you know, the way it starts and ends might be a little different, but what people start sharing is the language of the heart, and it's pretty much the same everywhere. Yeah. My sobriety date is July 14, 2002. I have a home group in Virginia Beach. It's the New Day Group. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. We'll be having what we call a sponsor line this week on Friday night at my house, where my sponsor and some guys he sponsors and guys I sponsor, we all get together and we check in on each of the three legacies, service, unity, and recovery, to see how we're doing in each of those, what stuff we're working on, what service work are we doing, do we have a home group, you know, there's a set of questions we ask, and then we throw in a bonus question, which is often, what are you doing for fun? Because, you know, a lot of people forget that in sobriety. They get so wrapped up in fixing things and getting everything back, you know, that we got to remember to have some fun. And so I'm from Charlottesville originally. I was there this weekend, stay with my brother in Forest Lakes. It only took me about 20 minutes to get here. That was kind of nice. It'll take a little longer to get home, but, you know, it's worth it. When I was a kid, I was a pretty happy kid. I do remember two things, though, that my brother actually reminded me of one from when I was a child. Well, that was when my mother made a cake, which was a big deal at our house. That didn't happen a lot. And when she would make a cake on somebody's birthday or whatever and cut it up, I would get down to table level and make sure nobody got a bigger piece than I did. You know? And so, yeah, I think I had that disease of more even then, you know, and self-centeredness, and, you know, I want the biggest piece. And my mother was also the disciplinarian, and that worked really well for my brothers and sisters. They turned into fine, upstanding citizens. But for me, I just learned how to get away with stuff, you know, and how to not get caught. And that seemed to serve me for a long time. But, of course, we all know that it all catches up with you. It catches caught up with me anyway and came crashing down. So I had my first drink when I was 8. It was a little family reunion at the house, and we snuck a beer out of the cooler. It was a Rolling Rock. That ought to tell you something, that I remember what that was, because I can't tell you who my third grade teacher was. But I can tell you that that was a Rolling Rock. And we, you know, it was probably five of us passed it around, one little 8-ounce bottle. But I immediately liked the way it made me feel. You know, I didn't get drunk, but I was the youngest of four. It made me feel older, cooler. I always thought the older kids got away with stuff. Again, you know, getting away with things, not following the rules. But they got to stay up later and go farther from the house. And so anyway, I did. I immediately liked the way it made me feel. And I didn't drink again until I was probably 13 or so, but... At that point, it started in earnest. I started to drink on the weekends. Even then, I was planning it. You know, where are we going to get it? Is there going to be enough? Are we going to hide it? Where are we going to hide it? You know, all those kind of questions. And we used to sneak in through people's doggy doors and steal beer. Or, you know, if somebody was babysitting, we'd, you know, take the vodka and then replace it with water, whatever it was. But and, you know, the drinking age was 18 then, so you'd get an older brother or somebody to buy it. And I got my first fake ID, I think I was 15, out of the Rolling Stone. And it worked, you know. It really wasn't a big deal then. I used to drink and go down and spin in the playground yard, you know, and get drunk. And, you know, again, you know, it seemed fun. I wouldn't have said that I was drinking because of fear at that time. But I would have admitted that it lowered my inhibitions. And what's the difference? Inhibitions are fears, right? But I wouldn't admit that because I was a man even at 15, you know. I was a pretty good, I was a good student. God gave me a good brain, but I didn't work very hard. It just came naturally. And I was a decent athlete. I played a couple of sports, had a bunch of letters. But I was an all-American partier, you know. That's what I liked. That's what I was a part of kind of every group. I didn't want to be excluded from anything. I liked being vice president of clubs, like the, you know, whether it was the SCA or the student, that's the student council, or maybe the chess club or whatever, because the vice president has a big title but doesn't do anything. You know, the president and the secretary and the treasurer do all the work. You know, so I loved that. But there was a club called the Key Club, and it was basically a fraternity, a high school, and we bought kegs with our money and had parties. I wanted to be president of that one, because the president controlled the kegs. And again, even then, if I looked at it honestly, I had the obsession because, you know, I would buy a keg of the Bull for the officers and Old Milwaukee for everybody else. And we'd had that one in the back, you know. Now, my mother got sick during that time and had cancer, and she ended up dying when I was 17, and I remember when they lowered her in the ground, I said, and she had taken me to church as a kid, tried to, like I say, she tried to teach me these principles, but in a way that I didn't like, you know. And so I went to church with her, and then I took the class. It was a Methodist church. When I was about 13, I took the confirmation stuff, and she said, at this point, it's up to you if you want to go. I never went back. And then when she died, I stood at her grave and said, well, this is all that's going to happen. I'm just going to have fun the rest of my life, and I'm not going to care about anything. And that meant I was going to drink. You know, that's what I equated with having fun. And so that kind of, you know, I had no spirituality, no spiritual connection. I turned my back on any of that at that point. And no higher power, if you will, because, like I say, I wasn't going to church, and my mother was dead, and she was my higher power up to that point. So, but I did, I got into some colleges. Like I said, I was born in Charlottesville. The rule in my house was you were going to college and you were paying your own way. Back then, it was a little cheaper. And so I had a paper route from the time I was 8, saved up. I got into several schools, a couple better than UVA. But I knew I was going to go to UVA, and not because it was the best education for the money, the best bargain, but because I was scared to leave town. I wouldn't have admitted that either. But I didn't want to. I'd been a big fish in a little pond. I did not want to go and be a little fish in a big pond somewhere else. I knew I would be that at UVA, but I would have my local friends, the guys I drank with, still around. And so first year at college, I did pretty well because I had all the courses before. And it really ticked off a lot of the guys who lived on my dormitory hall. You know, I had like a 3.5, and I was drunk every night. And I didn't know how to study, really. And that was the first time anybody ever said to me, you might be drinking too much. And I thought, what a nerd, you know? Didn't he know we're the cool guys? We're having fun, you know, all that. So I got my first DUI that year. I was driving through campus, going too fast. He pulled me over, you know, gave me a field sobriety test, blowing something. And on the way to the station, I started talking to him about UVA basketball, and we had a good conversation going. By the time we got there, he said, well, Mr. Hall, I don't think you're that drunk. If I hadn't have called it in, I'd let you go. Well, that, even though I still got charged, that blew my ego up. I said, you know, I can talk anybody out of anything. This isn't so bad. That's the one I always told myself. This wasn't as bad as I thought it'd be. And after he booked me, he took me to the party I was going to and dropped me off. So times were different. This was 1978. Yeah, and it was a little different back then. So I did go to ASAP class, and I went to one AA meeting. You know, you were supposed to go to a bunch. And I went to one meeting. It was at St. Paul's in Charlottesville. And as I remember it, and I'm sure this isn't the way it happened, they took all the newcomers and stuck them in a room by themselves, and nobody said a word for an hour. Yeah. But that's not the way it happened. I know now. I've been to that meeting since. But I knew y'all were talking about not drinking. So I didn't go back. I just signed that sheet myself. I was smart, you know. So I did that, and I ended up, I had 4 DUIs. I never went to another meeting for any of them. And So I got a girlfriend at that point. It was pretty much based on drinking and partying. We lived together 7 years. One thing, my second year of college, we got a house, my roommate and I, and we had a combined 1.02 grade point average. And I thought I was doing, I had a 0.82. I was doing all right, you know. And I said, they asked him to take a time off, you know, a little time off. I was able to stay because I was still right at a 2.0, I think. And my dad, for whatever reason, they sent my grades to my dad. And my dad was a real sweetheart and softy, and I always loved him. He was always nice to me. And one day he had moved away after my mother died because he couldn't stand being around Charlottesville. But he said, "Dave, come here. They sent me your grades, and you got an F in math. You know, you always did so well in math. What's going on?" You know, and I'm disappointed. And that one hurt. You can beat me and you can yell at me, but you tell me you're disappointed and I care about you, that hurt. And so I started going to class. I didn't stop drinking or slow down even. I just started going to class, and that was actually enough. I started doing the work. I could tell from what the professors talked about what was important. I was in computer science. God did that. I had no idea what I wanted to be. I knew I was good at math, so I went into engineering school, but I didn't want to be where's Rex? We have a bridge engineer here. I didn't want to be a civil or fluid mechanics or EE or any of that mechanical. But I took some computer classes, and I said, hey, I like this. This is easy. You know, it just fit me. So, but that also involved a lot of lab work, doing computer programming. And the lab was open in the middle of the night. So I ended up doing a lot of my work in the middle of the night when you could take a six-pack in there, and the other guys that drank six-packs were in there. And but I managed to get through college. And I was dating that woman. Actually, we were living together. We lived together for 7 years. And I had opportunities to leave Charlottesville. But I had a job at Sperry Marine down on 29. I'd worked there as an intern my last year of college. And they offered me what seemed like a boatload of money to me. Yeah, it was more than my dad had ever made. And he worked so hard, two jobs, you know, bringing up four kids. And I just think about all he did for us and how self-centered and selfish I was in my life. Luckily, through this program and the process of amends, I spent the last 10 years of his life, you know, basically as his best friend. So thank y'all for that. So anyway, I go to work at Sperry again. I was too scared to leave town. So now I've got local friends I drink with, UVA friends I drink with, work buddies I drink with. You know, every night's a party, right? What happy hour are we going to? What band are we going to see? The relationship, like I said, it lasted 7 years. It was based on partying. We loved each other, I believe, but we didn't know how to love each other. And I know I did, and I know that I was so emotionally bound up that I couldn't talk on any real level with her. She would ask me, "What are you thinking? How are you feeling?" And white noise would go off in my head, and I would just seize up, and I couldn't do that, you know. And so at some point, she stepped out, and then she wanted to come back home. And I wouldn't let her, and it wasn't because I didn't love her. It's because I knew I couldn't be there. I wasn't capable of having a human relationship, a real relationship like the book talks about. So about 2 years later, I get this letter in the mail, and it's from her. I know now it was an amends letter. I didn't know it at the time. And it had this little yellow book with it. It said, "Living Sober" on it. I was like, who would want to do that? You know, well, and again, I didn't get anything that the letter said. I threw it in the junk drawer with all the bills. Did anybody else have that magic drawer? You threw it, everything in it, and every so often I'd dump it, you know, in the trash. And then the Vepco guy would knock on the door or cut the power off, and I'd pay the bill then. How much money did I waste doing stuff like that, much less drinking? So anyway, I got my second DUI at about 26, and it involved some contraband. And so I had some some pretty hefty charges against me. And my buddies were outside the jail, and there was a high bond. They said they sent a note through the guard or a message. Do you want to get out now or have a bond hearing, see if you can get out for a little less on Monday? I said, get me out of here now. Because, you know, I had been praying. I would have told you I didn't believe in any God, but I was praying in that jail cell. Get me out of this. Please get me out of this. And as soon as we got out, they bonded me out. We went straight to a bar. It's insane, right? But it made perfect sense then. You know, I'm just going to go drink and forget about it and party on, rock, you know, whatever. And so I got a good lawyer. Again, my ego, I got off with a lot less than I should have, to tell the truth. And so again, I say, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. Dust myself off and keep going. I was on probation for a year, which limited my recreational activities. And but I was still able to drink, and I drank a lot, and I actually worked in Wales a lot that year, and they really like to drink over there, especially at lunch, which was kind of new to me. And so we got to lunch and have a few pints, and so, but during that time when I was in the States, I started working on a software program with a buddy of mine I went to college with, and we ended up getting it to a point. This was back in the DOS days. Anybody remembers DOS? And we made it at first for Screen Extender, which was the number one word processor at the time. Then what was the next one? It was done by WordPerfect. Yeah. So anyway, we developed the software, and we ended up being able to leave work and start this company. And if you had asked me, I'd have said, I'm doing this to get rich, right? You know, people are getting rich doing this. I want to get rich. But the truth is, I wanted to set my own hours. Because I had to go to work at 7 in the morning, and that did not work for me. Yeah. When I was at Sperry, they started at 7, and I could not get up and get there, you know. And I'd started sleeping in the bathroom, you know, going home and taking two-hour lunches. It was amazing they had kept me on that long. And so, I started working for this. My buddy and I started this company. He had a wife that was a doctor that went to MCV, and she didn't want to work at UVA Hospital when she finished. So she said, you want to go to Virginia Beach, Richmond, or Northern Virginia? Well, I had friends at Virginia Beach, and I always liked the beach. So I picked Virginia Beach, and we moved down there. I figured that was the one time I can remember saying, I'm going to slow down. I'm going to be away from all those people in Charlottesville that keep calling me up and making me go out, right? All these married guys that I grew up with, they get married, they get a night off, they call me. It's all their fault, right? You know? And so I said, I'm going to slow down. Well, you know the story. I took me with me. Within a week, I had a new bar and a new set of, I like to call them tornadoes. Like the book says, you know, we were tornadoes going through the lives of others. I was a tornado, and I liked hanging out with other tornadoes, you know, and for a while. But, you know, alcoholism is progressive, and more and more I became withdrawn. You know, alcohol is a depressant. I didn't understand that, because when I drank, it lit me up. But over time, it depressed me, and I started to not be the happy-go-lucky fella, not be, you know, really having no fun. And drinking alone, you know, and treating depression with isolation and loneliness with isolation. Got a couple more DUIs, you know, a couple more failed relationships. The business went under. I don't even really remember the 90s. That was when all this was going on. There's not a lot to it. There were no highlights, I can tell you that. There were a lot of lowlights, and I just went through some of those. I spent about 2 years on my couch on the north end. I would have told you that, well, I probably would have been diagnosed clinically depressed, you know. But the truth is I was just full of self-pity. Woe is me. Lost my mother, lost my girlfriend, lost my company. Why is all this happening to me? You know, all that selfish, self-centered thinking that characterizes me as an alcoholic. I could not have fathomed that I was self-centered or selfish. I never thought about stuff like that, you know? that was just too much thinking going on. And so I had another job or two. I got fired from one for borrowing the deposit one night, and I brought it back the next day, but they fired me anyway. Failed another test at another one. It was a railroad company. So I had a really good friend from college, a guy that lived on my hall first year, and he lived across the street from me. Actually, he's one of the main reasons I moved to Virginia Beach, because he lived there. And he came over one night and said, look, in the dark, my electricity was off. He said, I'll pay your electric bill, and I'll give you a job if you go to one meeting with a mutual friend of ours. That sounded like a pretty good deal. I'd give an hour up for a job and my electric bill being paid. And so I went to a meeting. It was the other fellowship. Afterwards, I told my buddy, and this was a guy I ran with hard down there, but he had been sober for 7 years. And he said, I said, you know, I got a problem with that, but drinking's not my problem, right? So I'm gonna keep drinking. So he was good. He said, okay, if you think you can do that, go ahead. And called me the next day and said, I talked to a lot of my friends that have a lot of time, and they said, there's about a 99% chance you can't do that. I said, watch me. And a week later, I got paid, and I was off to the races. You know, I got, Lord knows when my last had a legal license, and I remember I got pulled over for speeding, like I like to do. I wasn't drunk, but he got me for driving on a suspended license. And I remember driving in the back of the police car down to the station, thinking to myself, drinking's not my problem. Driving's my problem. And they had impounded my car, and I said, I'm just going to leave the car in the impound lot. Problem solved. Right? Smart. 3 months later, I got another one driving my friend's car. Because I needed beer. I needed to go to the beer store. I was an idiot. Just insane, really. That's all it is, just insanity. And so 2 years went by of me working for my buddy. I'm stealing from him. We make urban fashion for rappers. We do clothing lines for a couple of rappers. And I'm the IT guy. I'm not a rapper or the clothing designer. But anyway, it's very interesting work, but these clothes are hot commodity on the street. I could trade them for whatever I wanted. And they're not paying me enough, you know. He was paying me minimum wage, and that was being kind, to tell you the truth, because I was unemployable. I might show up two or three days a week, very seldom on time, often not wearing shoes. But in my mind, they're not paying me enough. Yeah, I'm justified in stealing these clothes, and I got caught a few times, and he covered me, and finally one day, and I was living in a hotel at this point. I was what I like to call functionally homeless. I was staying on couches if I could at the beach in the winter. The hotels you can stay in for like $150 a week, and they come in and clean it twice a week. That's a pretty good deal for an alcoholic. And I could pay them when I got paid, and I don't have to think about it. You know? And so I'm functionally homeless. It's the summer, the third year. What I would do is, in the summer, I'd get an apartment. I'd pay first and last month rent in like April. I wouldn't pay again, and they'd kick me out in September. Then I could go back to the oceanfront, you know. But nobody would do that anymore. I couldn't get an apartment. So I was living in this dive hotel in July. It was really gross. And he came in one morning. And my last drink was on... Actually, I went to high school with a couple guys from Dave Matthews. My last drink was on one of them's bus. So again, I thought I was hot snot, you know. Next morning, I went to work. And my buddy came in and said, I can't cover you anymore. You're fired. And I just felt, like the book talks about, I felt the fight drain out of me. I had nothing left. I could not argue. I couldn't beg. I was speechless. I was dumbfounded. I was scared to death because I knew there was nobody else I could manipulate or con, nobody that would take me in or help me out. And my life flashed in front of my eyes, and it wasn't the past. It was the future. the future. And I knew it was going to get worse, and it was already pretty bad. And I couldn't take it if it got any worse. And as he was walking out, he turned around with a little glint in his eye and said, "Do you want to go to treatment now?" And he had offered many times, and I'd always said, "If y'all would just leave me alone, I'll be okay." Anybody else ever say that? Just leave me alone. I'm not hurting anybody, right? That's the biggest lie I ever said. I'm not hurting anybody. And so it was like slow motion out of body. I was watching myself, and the word, "Yes," comes out of my mouth. And I wanted to grab it and stuff it back in, you know, but I said, "Yeah." And I could see the joy in his eyes. Because, I mean, that guy's a saint. He saved my life. And so that night, I stayed at work. I didn't have anywhere to go. There was a padlock on the door at the hotel, and I couldn't afford to get the padlock off. And, you know, my mind is such a mess at this point. I start thinking, the cops are going to drive by and see me in here. They're going to bust in and arrest me for, you know, burglary or something. And so I went out and slept in the woods that night. And I think part of me just knew I needed to do that too. And I go back to that spot every year because I need to see it. And the next day he came in and said, "Where'd you stay last night?" I said, "Under that tree over there." And he said, "All right, you can stay with me tonight and I'm going to take you to Williamsburg tomorrow." And so he took me up to treatment, and I checked in, and the doctor came in, and for the first time I was honest with somebody about what I was doing. You know, I was just broken and desperate, and I knew I didn't have anything to lose at this point. And I, you know, she didn't shudder or, you know, look aghast, although I expected her to. She just said, "Okay, I recommend you stay here 3 months." I said, "What?" She said, "I recommend you stay here 3 months." Because on the way up, I'd ask my buddy, "How long am I going to be here?" He said, "Oh, they got a 5-day evaluation." I said, "Oh, I can do 5 days, you know." And she recommended 3 months. I said, "Don't y'all have a 28-day program or something?" And she said, "Yeah, we can start with that." And I said, "Okay, let's do that." So then I went to my first little session, and it was a book study, the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And this is the first... Although I know now that my higher power was with me that whole time, protecting me, but also letting me go as far as I needed to go. And that night, that was the first time I can identify since getting here, and there have been many since, a little spiritual experience. And that was that they read the big book, the first 164 pages, you know, every night. But that night, they happened to be at the beginning and reading the doctor's opinion. And we read the doctor's opinion, and I said, "Oh, my God, I'm an alcoholic." Who knew? Everybody knew but me. But, you know, when it identified alcoholism as, you know, the inability to stop once I start and the ability to talk myself into it no matter what happened the time before, the physical craving and the mental obsession, I had to go. I looked all the way back, like I said, to high school, and I've been doing that. I always got drunk. And I was always thinking about it and planning it and talking myself into it, no matter what had happened before. And, but, you know, and that was a great relief, actually, to know what the problem was. And I took the first step that night right there and said, "I've got alcoholism." And, you know, I really didn't know what they say a lot, but I do believe that, you know, I'm not a bad person. I'm a sick person. And that really, that helped me to know that I had alcoholism. And that there was a solution. So I picked up a white chip. And they took us to a meeting that night. And knock on wood, so far, that's the only one. That night, like I say, I got the chip. I had no tools. I had nothing. They were talking about getting a sponsor and steps and stuff during the day. And we'd been there about 10 days. And we're sitting out in this Serenity Garden, you know, about 2 in the morning, swapping stories. The same stories we swapped in the bar, but we actually there was a different tint to it, and we were learning about really what insanity was and the things that we had done. And this nurse came out and said, "You guys need to go to bed. It's 2 in the morning." I got really pissed. Excuse my French. But I was upset. You know, who is she to tell me what to do? I'm a grown man. I'm in the asylum, but I'm a grown man, you know? And But I went to bed because I wanted to get an A in treatment, you know. And but I was upset, and I got down on my knees that night, and I said the serenity prayer over and over. That was the only tool I knew. And I got some sleep, and I woke up the next morning, and I was still upset, and I was in the shower, and I was reciting the serenity prayer. And this guy who had been there almost 3 months pulled me aside that morning. Now, he's an old-timer, you know, in almost 3 months. And it took, you know, I told y'all how smart I was, right? It took him about 2 hours to convince me that under that anger was fear. And that what I was scared of giving up was control. But once I got that and was able to see, I hadn't done a very good job when I was in control. I was in the asylum, right? Again. And maybe I needed to turn my will and my life over to something, you know, and not do it. And I went that night and read We Agnostics out of the big book, because I would have told you I was an atheist, you know, but really I was agnostic. I just didn't have any knowledge. And in the book, it's in my book still, I did a flow chart on the existence of God. Because I'm an engineer, right? So I started with, you know, there's no proof there's a God. And I said, but I have a soul and I can't see that. And I have a conscience and I can't see that. And when I let it go, where does it go? You know, all these questions like that. But at the end, I got around to, there's no proof there isn't. And that was enough for me to get started, you know. And so I think I took the second step that night. And when I did that, I decided I needed to start doing what people were suggesting that I do. I would say telling me to do, but I will say suggesting that I do. And that was the counselors and the people in AA. I got a sponsor. I stole him like I did everything else. You know, there was a guy on the phone in the hall talking to somebody. I said, "Who are you talking to?" He said, "My sponsor." I grabbed the phone from him. I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" He said, "Sure. Call me every night at 10 o'clock." I said, "What?" You know, it seemed a little excessive. I hadn't had a phone for 3 years. It was always bad news. Why would I have a phone? But I was scared to ask anybody else, so I called him every night. And we started going to dinner each week. He started me working the steps. He had me write out my drinking history. And we went through that, and then he showed me all the places where there had been a higher power looking out for me, where it could have been a whole lot worse. A whole lot worse. And that guy helped me tremendously. And so I ended up, and I also said, okay, I'll do the 3 months. So I stayed there for 3 months. But towards the end of that, I didn't have anywhere to go back to. You know, I had no apartment. I had nowhere to live. And my buddy, who's also my boss, he offered to get me an apartment and furnish it. And I guess say the guy's a saint, but he didn't exactly know who he was dealing with. And I knew that I could not do that. I couldn't go back to living by myself, because I would just go right back to doing the same stuff. So they suggested I go to an Oxford house. And I called every day for 2 weeks, the last 2 weeks I was in there. And no beds, no beds. There were 4 Oxford houses in Virginia Beach. No beds, no beds. And another spiritual experience, the last day, we got a bed. And I was able to go to that Oxford house. And my buddy came and picked me up. And on the way back, he said, "You want to go to the office?" Everybody, he was giving me my job back. And he said, "You want to go to the office? Everybody misses you and wants to see you." I said, "No, I need to go to a meeting." He said I needed to go to a meeting as soon as I got back, and that's what I did. And I work a lot in the Virginia Beach Psych Center. I take meetings upstairs there. And the people that go to meetings right away and get involved, they got a good shot, you know. And I sponsor a bunch of those guys, and it keeps me right back in it. I love it. So I get back to Virginia Beach. I'm in this Oxford house. You know, I still don't know what's going on. I'm scared to death. I don't know if I can do this. I haven't done anything successful in a long time. You keep hearing me say I, right? So, yeah, I. But I did put myself in the middle of AA, and you guys did it. You know, I got found a home group with a bunch of guys that they came to me and talked and pulled me in, had me start making coffee. I didn't even drink coffee. Coffee was bad for you. I'd do anything else you put in front of me, but I did not drink coffee. I drew the line right there. And I drink a lot of coffee now. So anyway, this guy has helped me do that. I decided I'd go by DMV and find out, you know, just how long it might be before I could get a license and how much I owed. And the lady looked at me and said, "You were eligible to get your license on October 4th. And that was the day I got out of treatment. I mean, things were happening that I had no control over, that I was not doing. I was doing this. I was doing AA. And the rest of that stuff was, for the most part, taking care of itself. It was hard not to start believing, right? And I get goosebumps still thinking about it. It took 5 trips to DMV to actually get the license. Yeah, this was right after 9/11, and they were very tight, so I had to get this paperwork and that paperwork. But I did get a license. My sister gave me an old beater. I was taking a walk, which is the way I meditate. I'm able to release everything when I do that. And I remember thinking, you know, I got this car. Maybe I'll go visit my old girlfriend. And then I had the thought, they'll probably be drinking over there, and that's not such a good idea. And then I had a thought that was definitely not me. It was out of left field. You should use that car to take somebody to a meeting, you know? And I thought, man, I'm really smart. And I called my sponsor in Williamsburg. I was still using him. It had been about a month. I told him that story, tapped myself on the back. He said, "Don't call me again until you get a sponsor in Virginia Beach." He said, "You almost went over there drinking. You're not well. You need somebody so you can see face to face, you know, on a regular basis." And he was right. And so I asked the guy who was at most of the meetings I went to that shook the book at you when he shared, but he helped me tremendously. He took me 3 through 9. He kept asking me. Oh, and I also found a guy that I picked up every day for a year. I have no idea where he is now, but that guy kept me sober for a year. Yeah. But anyway, my sponsor kept saying, "When are you going to do your 4-step? You know, I'm getting to it. But the truth is, I hadn't done 3. Even though I'd taken 2, I believed there was a solution, and I was praying, and I knew it was working for you guys. I really didn't know how to turn it over, you know. So I started thinking about drinking, you know, because all the stuff I had done started swimming around in my head, all that dirty, nasty, rotten stuff. And the natural reaction to change the way I feel, to quiet that, is to drink. And I was going to meetings, and I was calling my sponsor, and I hadn't told him about it. But I went to a meeting, you know, I could taste it, actually, one night. And I went to a meeting, and left the meeting, and I wasn't feeling much better. I came to a T intersection, and the Oxford House was a mile one way, and my favorite bar was a mile the other way. And I said, "God, please get me home tonight." And that was my 3rd-step prayer. The book says, you know, the wording is quite optional, but I abandoned myself to God at that point. I said, "Please get me home." And when I woke up the next morning, without thinking, I knew what to do. I went to the library and I started writing it down, the 4-step. And it took about 2 days, maybe 10 hours, and it was a lot. But I tell you, just getting it out of my head on the paper helped so much. And then when I get, you know, we did it in the kitchen at the place, you know, just like that at the church where we had our meeting. And I felt even better. It wasn't a white light experience or any of that. I just felt lighter, you know. And I believed I was forgiven, and I knew that I had work to do. But and then we did 6 and 7, pretty much boom, boom, out of the book. Today I know that I'm still doing 6 and 7 every day. My defects have many heads, many ways of rearing themselves. But it's a whole lot better than it was, don't get me wrong. And, you know, I've learned when I, just like with the drink, I had to put the plug in the jug for a while. At least this is how it worked for me. And then God removed the obsession. It's the same with my defects. When I have to recognize them, not do them, and once I do that long enough, God removes it. But it's always on the shelf, just like a drink, for me to grab and use again. So we did that. I made a list in step 8, and he gave me a script for step 9. He said, "You say, this is what I did. It was wrong. This is what I'm doing to make up for it. And this is what I'm doing so it won't happen again." And and I set out to make amends with those words. And I wouldn't recommend this to anybody, but my sister-in-law had entered another 12-step program as a result of me being, and that's, again, a miracle. Me being an AA has done a lot of healing within my family that I never expected to happen. Not only with them getting help, but just, you know, we never said I love you because we never did that when we were kids. Our parents never did it. But I just started doing it, and now everybody does it. And, I mean, there's just a lot of benefit to that. But anyway, she was having her 50th birthday party, and I asked her, I said, you know, everybody's going to be there. Do you mind if I make some amends? And she said, sure. And so that night, and I was scared to death, I prayed the whole way up there to Charlottesville, Virginia Beach. But this peace, at the end, this peace came over me. It was, again, another little spiritual experience. It all adds up to that spiritual awakening, you know. But I went around to each person and made an amends to each of them, you know, that this is what I did to you, and it was wrong, and this is what I'm doing to make up for it, and this is what I'm doing so it won't happen again. And it was it was just powerful. It was a lot of love. I received a lot of love from that. After that, I had to follow it up with action, though, and, you know, I started sending birthday cards, making phone calls, returning phone calls. You know, I used to get mad because nobody was calling me, but I never called them back. You know, why would they call me anymore? And visiting, showing up when I said I'd show up on time. You know, I think it's amazing how simple this stuff all gets when I just start doing that. You know, because my mind, when I resist, it persists. And my mind wants to resist all the time. But when I get it done, I go, God, I wish I'd done that earlier. You know, I wish I'd gotten to that earlier. But it took a while. I had a lot of old landlords to make amends to, and, you know, some romantic relationships. Some I made, some I had to let God take care of. I sat down with most of my coworkers, all my bosses. But, you know, that's the freedom. Step 9 is where the freedom is. We do all the other ones to get to 9, and I see a lot of people balk at 9. And I didn't hurt that many people, and that may be true. But I know for me, it was a long list, and it's still people that pop up every so often that I've forgotten about. And when I go to Charlottesville, I run into them, you know. But I'm able today to walk down the street with my head up and see them coming. And go up and say hi, and say, you know, I hurt you. I did this, and it was wrong. And, man, it feels so good to be able to do that, to just be able to be a human being, you know. It was a step up for me, I can tell you that. You know, 10, 11, and 12, doing them every day. I am involved in service and sponsorship. I went from the coffee commitment to doing every position in my home group, then I did everything. I was the chairperson, and I said, all right, I'll do the alternate GSR, right? I'm going to take a little break and sit back. 3 months later, the GSR moves, and I'm the GSR, you know. So then I said, people encouraged me to run for office. I said, I'll do alternate DCM, right? I'll take another break, and 3 months later, the DCM moves, and I'm the DCM. But I can tell you I had no idea what I was doing. But everybody helps and pitches in, and God shows us the way, and it's just more of the we thing, you know. And it's taught me so much about how to live with other people, being in service, not just with my family, with people at work, the traditions, all those things have made me such a more well-rounded individual in all my affairs. I mean, to get up in front of, I don't know 49 of you, I know one of you, you know, be able to tell this. I mean, I can tell you anything today. It was on my fist up. I was so scared to share any of that with anybody. You know, I don't have any secrets now. And my family, like I said, is, you know, my relationships are much better. There's one brother who's estranged from the rest of the family, but we have managed to start a relationship back up, and I'm hoping. I just waited basically for God to make that happen. He actually had a problem. His wife kicked him out, sent him to me. I took him to some meetings. It was a different fellowship. Found him a treatment center. He went home. She said, you can't have any contact with the family because they're the reason this happened. So for 8 years, I waited. But the time came when we started talking again. And I knew he needed to do that to be with his kids, and I didn't want to get in the middle of that. But so, you know, that's good. I've gone back to school. I'm a vice president at work. But I found out when you're at work and you're a vice president, you do a lot of work. It's not like high school. But, you know, I'm at the same place. I used to hate that place, you know. I hated the work. I hated the people there. I hated Virginia Beach. And today I love it all. I love those people. They haven't changed. But they were always, you know, pretty good folks. It was just me and my resentments. We read that story the other day, my bottles, my resentments, and me. You know, that was it. Like I said, I went back to school. I thought I'd tried sober. I did very well. You know, I finally learned how to study. But I was so scared. There was a lot of presentations in front of people. I used to listen to AA tapes every day on the way to school. A couple of John the Indian. Anybody know him? You know, couldn't read, and then he became a college professor. And there was a girl who was 14 and homeless and used to smoke cigars and go to the meetings barefoot, and she became a lawyer. You know, just miraculous things happen here. I'm so grateful to be a part of it. I get so much more out of this than I put into it. And, you know, I'm a math guy, and all the people I know that have what I want would say the same thing. So if I add it all up, you know, where does all that extra come from? It comes from your higher power and your higher power and my higher power. Thanks.